Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into the Temple Bar Investment Trust. We're going to be looking at the strategy, we're going to be looking at some of the individual names within the portfolio, and we're also going to be looking to the future and where the trust sees opportunities. And to discuss all of that, we're very kindly joined by fund manager Nick Purvis. Nick, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Pleasure, John. Pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
As I said, we're going to be taking a very close look at the trust. We're going to start off and we're going to look at the macro environment, and then we're going to move on and look at individual names. But before we get into it, please would you be able to give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself as well as the trust, please?
Yeah, of course. Well, the trust itself goes back many, many years. I think to the 1920s. I think it's actually, whether it's reached its centenary yet, or I don't know. But the trust wants to be known, I think, as basically the UK value trust. So for those investors who are looking to invest in the more lowly valued companies within the UK stock market, the Temple Bar is placed that those investors should come. I manage the trust with a colleague, a chap called Ian Lance, and we have managed the trust since the autumn of 2020. So just coming up 4 years. And as I said earlier, very much to what's called a value discipline, looking to invest in the more lowly valued or undervalued companies within primarily the UK stock market.
Thank you very much. So you did mention there, Nick, value. And, you know, that's something that I do want to spend a bit of time on, because, you know, it's an interesting topic, especially in the context of what's been happening over the last decade or so. So, you know, the first point here would be the approach to UK equity, of course, is value. But, you know, for people listening to this, it can be quite a broad term. So it would be good if you'd be able to set the scene for us in terms of what you mean by value, the types of stocks, the types of characteristics that you're looking for when you're mentioning value within your approach.
Okay, so absolutely. So I think probably just maybe take one step back before defining our view of, or our take on value, I think is to answer perhaps an obvious question, which is, you know, why are we value investors? And I think, you know, the reason essentially that we are value investors is because there is a large amount of empirical evidence to show that systematically investing in the more lowly valued companies within the stock market over the long run, and it's important to emphasize the long run, has led to some quite significant excess returns over time. And I think I suspect a lot of your listeners will be asking themselves the question, you know, why should it be that lowly valued companies, often who operate in, you know, challenging industries, why should lowly valued companies deliver you higher levels of investment return over the long term? And I think, you know, our answer to that is it's the stock market's way of paying you for being prepared to be uncomfortable, to take on controversy, to invest in companies, as I say, where perhaps it's not all plain sailing. And as you know, very simply, our job as the investment managers on the Temple Bar Investment Trust is to extract that excess return that comes from investing in values or lowly valued companies over time. And we move on to your question, which was, okay, well, fine. Well, how do you define value? Because you're absolutely right to say that different value managers, so-called value managers, you can define a value differently. We think, you know, as I think many of us will appreciate, you know, there are many companies out there which perhaps operate in cyclical industries where they go through good years and bad years, and where the profitability of the company can move up and down from one year to the next. And that of course creates a challenge when it comes to valuing the company, because as your listeners will know, the fair value of a company to its shareholders, or the true value, is the sum of all the cash flows that accrue to those shareholders from the company over time. Well, how do you value the business when those cash flows or profits are moving up and down from 1 year to the next? And so, you know, our take on value, what we try to do is we try to understand for each individual company, what is a reasonable profit expectation for the company in a typical year? Not in the good times, not in the bad times, but in a steady state, if you like. And we try and basically value the company off that level of cash flows using what we hope is quite a conservative multiple to capitalize that profit stream and arrive at a view of, you know, our view of the fair or intrinsic value of the business. And if our view of the fair value of the business is at a significant premium to the market value of the business, the value that's being accorded to the business by the stock market today, then it's a candidate for investment. So that's how we think about value, in inverted commas.
Thank you, Nick. So I would like to, if we may, take it a level deeper. And of course, you mentioned there that the gap between the market value and the intrinsic value, and you also mentioned multiples that you may be looking at. I don't know how much of this you're going to be able to share with listeners, but I'm sure it was something that they'd be interested to hear about. But when you're looking at companies and you're looking for an intrinsic value, what are the key metrics? What are the key ratios that you're using? Are you very much looking on an earnings basis? Is it blended possibly with book value? Do you pay a lot of attention to discounted cash flows? The methodology behind determining an intrinsic value for a company. I'd be interested to hear a little bit more about that.
It's essentially earnings and cash flow. And I think we could give a quick example. If you think about, take a typical company, let's take a bank, for example. There's probably half a dozen key levers of value in a bank. The first lever might be the equity base and the extent to which the bank can gear the equity base, i.e. how much business can it write on the back of its equity base. And of course, the regulator takes very close interest in that. And then you have to ask yourself, you know, what is in a normal interest rate environment, what is a reasonable level of net interest margin? So you can form a view of that. You might then ask yourself, well, what is a reasonably efficiently run retail bank? What level of cost is it likely to run against that income? And a reasonably efficient retail bank should run with a cost income ratio of around close to 50%. And then you can form a view of what is a typical level of loan losses? Again, not in a brilliant year, not in a terrible year, but in an average year. And you can work through these numbers and you can form a view of, as I said earlier, a view of the company's profits or profitability in a typical year. And then we would use that as a reference point on which to value, in this case, a bank. And then I suppose your next question is, how do you value that profit stream? What multiple or what capitalization rate, that's where you want to think about it, do you attach to that profit stream? Well, that comes down to the type of the business. And there is always an element of judgment involved in that. So is it a relatively stable business where profits from 1 year to the next don't deviate that much? Or is it quite a cyclical business where the good years are very different from the not so good years? And of course, you'll instinctively know that banking as an industry is quite a cyclical industry. So we accordingly, as a result of that, we wouldn't want to attach too high a multiple to a bank's profits in order to form a view of an intrinsic value. So we might value a bank's profits, I don't know, let's say, okay, we'll call it a price earnings ratio of 12 times. And again, that will get you to, I say, a view of intrinsic value. And where that view of intrinsic value is a long way, and I'm placing emphasis on the words long way, because the margin of error is not big, where that intrinsic value view of intrinsic value is a long way above today's market value, then that company certainly becomes a candidate for investment.
Thank you very much. So I'd like to move on to the macro perspective, Nick, please. And it's quite interesting what you said about looking at a company in a in a typical year? Because that would suggest to me that, that maybe the macro picture isn't that important for you when you're looking at the valuation of a business. But you know, taking a step back and looking at the UK, you know, what are the influences that you see supporting the value area of the market as opposed to the growth market? You know, there has been a lot of talk about the UK being good value for some time now, but still we have relatively low valuations compared to overseas peers. You know, are there any catalysts that you see on the horizon that may spur a re-rate in UK stocks?
Okay, so there's quite a lot to cover in there. I mean, I think just to start off on the macro, I just want to be clear that we absolutely don't build a portfolio with a view of the macroeconomic outlook in mind. Everything we do, we come at everything from a stock specific perspective. So we're looking at companies, trying to understand their valuation, trying to understand the risks that surround that company. So it's very much our analysis or our research into companies is very much driven by the stock specific. You know, I think one reason that we don't build a portfolio from the top down, i.e. with a view of the macroeconomic outlook, you know, using that as a basis on which to build a portfolio, is because it is so hard, I'm going to say impossible, to predict where the economy is going to go. And you've only got to look at the record of the very large majority of forecasters out there to understand that it's pretty much impossible to know with any confidence, you know, where the economy might be 12 months from now. So, and that, of course, is why we look at companies, you know, using cycle average earnings, because we're trying to effectively remove the sort of inherent volatility that comes from the economy. But obviously, you need to, whilst you can't predict the macroeconomic outlook, that's not the same as saying you completely ignore the macro. You need to understand, have some feel for what's going on in the economy, because it can give you context. And that is really important. And I think you didn't need to know, I mean, going back some time now, going back pre the financial crisis in 2008, you didn't need to be able to predict that the financial crisis was going to strike in 2008 in order to understand in 2007 that conditions were quite frothy, that lending standards amongst the banking industry had become too loose, and that risk controls had effectively, you know, gone to the wall. And obviously that exposed companies to significant levels of risk. So we try and understand the macro because it helps us understand context, but we don't select a group of companies based on where the economy is going.
Thank you. There's a couple more questions on here which might elaborate on that point a little bit more, but that was very clear, Nick. Thank you.
Well, I didn't go. You finished up by asking the question, you know, recognizing the UK has looked good value for some time.
Yeah, it's just looking at the broader picture, Nick. You know, I think it'd be good if you could speak to as a UK value investor. We've been talking about good value in UK equities forever and a day now, it seems, and they remain good value. So, you know, the question was more to get your insights into, you know, what you feel.
Yeah,
could
so
be
I mean,
a
I think these things are difficult to measure. From between one geography and another, is always difficult to measure. But we do think it does seem to us that the UK stock market does continue to suffer from a discount, and where that's a kind of perhaps most obvious is where you have a company which is quite international in nature, which happens to be listed in the UK, and where that the valuation attached to that company is at a significant discount to another similar company in an overseas jurisdiction, which effectively, from an operational perspective, has the same geographic footprint. And so, you know, a good example might be, let's go to energy. So a good example might be Shell, for example. So Shell is, I mean, it's listed in the UK, but of course, it's a very small portion of its business is conducted in the UK, I mean, well under 10%. And that company is valued on a price earnings ratio of around 8 times, that sort of number. Compare it to Exxon in the US, which is obviously a very similar business. It operates in the same industry and has a not dissimilar geographic footprint. Happens to be listed in the US, obviously, where valuations generally are higher. And that company would trade on a price earnings ratio of, let's say, 11 to 12 times, that sort of number. So you might be up to about a 50% premium. And it's in those types of situations that you can see perhaps most clearly that there does continue to be a UK stock market discount. And you're right to point out that that has been there for some time. And of course, that begs the next question, which is, well, fine. Okay, so that might look good value. The UK might look good value, but what's going to change that? I think 2 points here. One is, contrary to popular opinion, you don't actually need the valuation of the UK to move up very significantly in order to get some very good returns out of UK equities. Because what you must remember is that these companies, whilst they're sitting on these low valuations, they are paying you often very attractive dividend yields. And they are also using their cash flows to, in many cases, to buy back cheap stock and through share buybacks. And, you know, what is perhaps not so obvious from the outside is when a company, so let's keep the example of Shell. So if Shell's on a, let's say, a cash PE of 8, you can turn that on its head. That's a cash flow yield, a free cash flow yield of, let's say, 12%. And Shell is a good example of a company that's pretty much returning all of its free cash flow to shareholders at the current time. And it can do that two ways. As I said, you can do that through a dividend or a share buyback. At the moment, Shell's probably returning you 4% of that 12% as a dividend, and it's using the other 8% of free cash flow to basically retire stock. And so what that means is that every year you get your 4% dividend. That means if you're reinvesting that dividend, you're ending up with, all other things being equal, 4% more shares than you started off with. And then every year that it uses 8% of its market capitalization to buy back cheap stock, it's reducing the shares in issue by 8%, which means that every pound of profit that it generates next year is worth 8% more to its shareholders than the pound of profit generated next year. So shareholder returns can drive real value for shareholders in the absence of a re-rating. And you can almost think of your free cash flow yield as your total shareholder return. Obviously, that which is coming back through as a dividend is your income or dividend return. And that which is coming back through a share buyback is effectively your capital return, because that is driving future earnings per share growth. So companies that trade on those sorts of multiples do generate very significant value for their shareholders, even in the absence of a re-rating. Now, if you're lucky enough and the shares do re-rate from, I don't know, 8 times to 11 times, and 11 times is not an aggressive multiple, that's around another 40% on the share price. So just want to try and scotch this notion that you need a re-rating in order to enjoy very good investment returns. So that's point number one. And point number two is that rating is driven by investor sentiment. Will they be in the mood to drive up the rating on UK equities? Well, we don't know, is the honest answer. And again, no one really knows the answer to that. Except to say, when you're starting on an average PE of 8, and as I say, the Temple Bar portfolio is on an average PE of 8, then you're more likely to enjoy a re-rating from a PE of 8 than you are a D rating. So you're effectively stacking the odds in your favor. Now, there are reasons to be hopeful that actually UK equities can re-rate over time. And I think the reasons to be hopeful for that, it is because the level of takeovers in the UK market seems to have gone up quite significantly. It picked up pretty significantly in 2023, but it's picked up even further so far in 2024. The Temple Bar portfolio in the first 9 months or so of this year has received takeover bids for 4 of the companies in the portfolio. And of course, whether the company ends up being taken over, whether the takeover bid is successful or not, it's very good for portfolio share prices. So that's an increase in the number of takeover bids is an indication that overseas buyers, and it is normally overseas buyers, see value in the UK and are trying to take advantage of it. And the other reason perhaps to be optimistic is that the level of share buybacks has picked up pretty dramatically. And that is basically, we think there's two things. One is that corporate profitability is quite strong at the moment. So companies are generating a decent amount of cash. Finances and balance sheets are in a good state. So they're asking themselves, what should we do with that cash flow? Well, the best thing that we can do is buy back cheap stock. Because when you buy back cheap stock, you're driving enormous value creation for the shareholders who choose not to participate in the share buybacks. And of course, on a P of A, we're not participating on behalf of Temple Bar in those share buybacks. And as investors generally start to understand that share buybacks and shareholder returns generally are on the increase, then that may lead to a re-rating in the UK market in the coming months.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Nick. That was fascinating. So we're going to take a more stock-specific approach to the conversation. And there's a couple of companies that I've picked out here that I'd like to discuss. But I do want to start with a sector which I didn't see in the top 10 holdings. And, you know, it's quite interesting what you said in terms of the macro picture that you don't particularly invest just because of macro themes, but it's the house building sector. And, you know, looking at what's been happening in the UK and look at what's been happening with those share prices, you know, it was interesting to see that there weren't any house builders in the top 10 of Temple Bar. So, you know, really the question is, you know, what's the thinking behind that? Of course, you know, when you look at some of these companies, you know, they have been very heavily hit. Of course, there's been a rally there. But, you know, now with this Labour government coming in promising 1.5 million homes, you know, that would suggest that they're going to be a little bit busier in the coming years and should have higher profits. So yes, Nick, really question around the house builders. How do you view them? And you know, is that a sector that you may be looking at in the future, if not now?
So first thing is, we'll be the first to admit that house builders are difficult to value. And again, this comes back to this volatility we were talking about earlier. House builder profits are very volatile and, you know, ultimately driven by what's happening in the housing market to house prices. And you've seen that in spades, haven't you, over the last few years. So obviously, any company where the profit stream is volatile, they are more difficult to value. I think, you know, I mean, please understand where we're coming from. You're right, we don't have any house bills in the Temple Bar Investment Trust portfolio. That doesn't mean we think they're expensive. All we're saying is, in our view, they haven't been cheap enough. We have owned house builders, going back a long time ago. We owned them during the financial crisis, when you could buy them actually on half times their book value. And yes, our clients did very well out of that when coming out of the financial crisis. And yes, you're absolutely right. There has been dislocation in the house building sector in the last few years, but they haven't, in our view, got to the level where they're just... The valuation is upside to intrinsic value is large enough. So many of them trade around book value. We'd like to see them at a reasonably significant discount to book value. So, you know, I keep coming back to the banks, for example. You can buy, so a company like Standard Chartered, the Asian focus, but you can buy today at a significant discount to book value. That is not the case in the house building sector. So we just, nothing wrong with the sector per se. In our minds, it's just the valuations, in our view, are not there at the moment.
Thank you. So next, Marks and Spencer, been a huge company in terms of returns for investors recently. And just reading through one of your latest fact sheets, I think it was one of the biggest contributors to returns for Temple Bar. But of course, it's been on a very strong rally. And, you know, the question is here, Nick, you know, at which point does it start to look not expensive, but maybe one that isn't offering as much value as it once did? And, you know, is that time approaching for you? Or indeed, do you see stronger earnings for Marks & Spencer going forward? And is it a company that you may add to?
Marks & Spencer is in in a way, it's a great example of the sort of company that we look for the trust. I mean, Marks & Spencer has obviously had its fair share of problems. It operates in a challenged industry. I mean, life generally has been difficult for retailers everywhere. There's been a huge amount of channel shift and change in consumer tastes. And Marks & Spencer got very, very behind the curve, and the business was underperforming for a long period of time. But and you know, we're all as consumers, we're all familiar with that. Having said that, we never lost sight of the fact that actually underneath it all, there's actually a very good brand. It's one of the UK's favorite brands. It's a place where consumers have continued to come back to. And I think I'm right in saying that even post a period of, a long period of poor operational performance, it never stopped being the number one clothing retailer in the UK. So we've always felt that there is a fundamentally not a bad business there, which has not been run to its potential. Now that today we think that is changing, and that the existing management team are doing an excellent job in realizing the full potential of the company. Share price today is around £3.60. If it got down to during COVID, it got down to about a pound. It was just extraordinary. We think the earnings power of the business is 30-35p, that sort of number. And so actually, we continue to think that it looks pretty reasonably priced at the current level. I mean, to state the obvious, it doesn't offer the upside that it once did. But that doesn't mean that we're not happy to continue holding it. We do absolutely believe that there's more to come from the company, whilst recognizing that they've done a great job already.
Yeah, so just on Marks and Spencer, still, Nick, when you're looking at the company, is it very much a food business for you now? Do you see any value in the clothing side, or is it just something that you feel could just slip away into the background as Marks and Spencer continues to focus on the food business?
No, we very much see it as both. We don't see it as clothing or food. We see it as both. Absolutely.
Thank you. So next up, BP and Shell. You have spoke about Shell, but we're going to treat the two in one in terms of this point here. And it is looking at the oil prices. Now, of course, as you said, you don't take any one year's earnings in your evaluations of the business. But of course, if we do see oil prices stay at these levels, maybe even go a little bit lower, at what point does it become a problem for your investment case?
Well, when do the numbers no longer stack up? I mean, I think you need oil prices probably, I would say, below $60, but probably to stay there. But not only is not where they go, is where they end up, if you like. If oil prices were sustained below $60, I think you could reasonably say that the numbers the shares no longer look attractively valued. You're right to point out, of course, we don't value the companies off the oil price today. We value the companies off of what we think is a reasonable expectation for long-term oil prices. And the energy companies themselves use between $70 and $80 a barrel Brent. And that's the oil price that they use when they're evaluating new projects. And so that's the oil price that we use when trying to value the companies. And $70 to $80 a barrel, as I said, you use the example of Shell, they're trading on around seven to eight times earnings, which of course we think is a very attractive level. Operationally, I mean, obviously Shell is performing better than BP. BP's had its fair share of problems over the years, but as I say, the sector as a whole, we think it's pricing in a relatively low oil price, and as I say, we would hope that as oil prices head towards that $70 to $80 a barrel over time, then the share prices continue, the companies can continue to deliver some good returns.
Thank you. So I want to move on to the Temple Bar dividends, Nick. Now, I understand it was increased recently. you know, what does it look like for investors going forward? Can they expect more increases? Can they expect the dividend to stay the same? And what was the key driver at this point in time to see that tick up in the dividend?
Okay, so I think that looking backwards first, the reason for the tick up in dividend has been effectively strong corporate profitability. So generally, companies, obviously, there are many companies that had a pretty horrible experience during COVID, either suspended or cut their dividend. And, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? You know, and actually, obviously, there was a huge amount of uncertainty during 2020. It actually turns out that there are a good number of, because actually the economy's recovered pretty strongly in 2021, there are a good number of companies out there with the benefit of hindsight that didn't actually need to cut their dividends. And so as corporate profitability has recovered very strongly post the pandemic, so dividends have recovered strongly from a relatively low base. And I think you continue to see that coming through in 2023 and into 2024. Looking forward, yes, of course, we absolutely, you know, aim to continue to grow the trust dividend. There's always risk, you know, and the risk can come from either corporate profitability itself or the currency, for example. So a good portion of the portfolio's dividends are recorded and paid in dollars. If you ended up in that situation where actually sterling strengthened quite significantly, and it has actually been reasonably strong recently, then obviously mathematically dollar dividends are worth less to sterling-based shareholders. So there's always risks surrounding dividends, but absolutely over time, there's, you know, the intention and the hope is to continue to grow the dividend at a healthy rate. I think it's important to set expectations correctly. You know, as I said earlier, you've seen a big recovery in the trust dividend in 21, 22 and 23. I think shareholders should not expect that rate of recovery to continue, because that recovery is really largely making up for the ground that was lost in 2020. So we'd expect a more normal level of dividend growth, mid-single digit dividend growth going forward. That would be our hope and expectation.
Thank you. So to finish off here, final point, Nick, and you know, as an investor in UK value, what excites you the most when you're looking ahead over the next 12 months? So what are the factors within the market that, you know, really have you you know, looking at your portfolio and feeling quite happy about what you've got at the moment?
What excites us is, you know, in my experience, and I've been around a little while, it is stocks are cheap for one of two reasons: either because of controversy, because there's something that the stock market actively doesn't like or worries about with regards to the companies. And investing in controversy can be extremely profitable. And we made a lot of money for the investment trust during COVID, because obviously a huge amount of controversy and uncertainty at that point in time. But controversy is scary, because ultimately none of us really know how things will pan out. And the second reason that shares can be cheap, it's neglect. It's not that the market is saying that there's necessarily anything particularly wrong with the companies. The companies just don't have the excitement factor that the stock market is looking for at that point in time. And we think that we are in that neglect situation today. And we think that many investors and, you know, investors generally have become somewhat obsessed by the US market, which obviously has delivered some very attractive returns over recent years. But it's important to look forward and not backwards. And of course, US tech in particular, and the so-called Magnificent Seven, and within US tech, anything with an AI label attached to it. So what we think is happening is that investors are becoming slightly myopic, and in their desperation to get exposure to anything with an AI label attached to it. And the result of that is that they're selling or ignoring companies where there's nothing wrong with them. They're not particularly exciting, but the result is you can buy some perfectly reasonable businesses on mid to high single digit price earnings ratios. That's what gets us exciting, because when the crowd changes their mind, and that at some point is likely to happen, then the scope for that neglected group of stocks to deliver some really, really good returns is there. So that's what excites us.
That's great, Nick. Thank you very much. Just a note to listeners, do check out the notes to this podcast because there'll be a link through to the Temple Bar website, and also check out the Investment Trust Centre on the UK Investor Magazine website, where there'll be further information about Temple Bar. So, Nick, thank you very much for being with us today.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.